Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, Jay, David, and Vicki sit down with Dr. J.D. Green, Extension Professor with the University of Kentucky Cooperative Extension Service. As always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
Y'all get good and rested up?
Sure.
We spent the last week at our State Ag Agents Association conference held there at Kentucky Dam Village. And, you know, folks may be listening to this a year from now, and it may not play anything into, but for the most part, for us to be here and be functioning after a week like we had, it takes a little bit to get over that much work all at once.
Yeah, that planning and, you know, we were all kind of in charge of the banquet, and so all of that rolled through and lots of different activities that we had to kind of get taken care of. But all went well and had a great meeting, and so...
And the weather was really great.
Oh, it's perfect. I mean, you couldn't ask for any better.
It's great weather.
Really good conference. Everything about it went off well. I will say we probably had more good comments about the banquet than any other single part of it. Picnic got quite a few as well, but the two of you were in charge of getting the banquet put off without a hitch, and it was really nice.
Food was really good, and Vicki and I had them stepping and fetching. And it didn't take near as long. Greg Drake told me that the first time he'd ever gotten out of a banquet during the daylight. So,
last year's was around 3 hours. This one of the agents working with us, Daryl Simpson, timed you. It was an hour and 44 minutes.
Including the meal.
Including the meal. Yep. So, that's
went well.
When we got up there for the awards part, and David and I got up there to stand on the opposite side, I thought, I don't know if we look like security guards or ushers or what, but.
Well, it was really good program. The food was excellent, which is a plus for any banquet, but it wasn't just fast. It was really good. A lot of good awards given out, a lot of good people there. And
well, and it, you know, when David and I were planning that, it's, you want to keep it moving, but you also want to give it the time that it deserves.
Right.
So you didn't want it to feel rushed, but at the same time, you didn't want to keep them there for 4 hours. So,
and we had a long program to get through too.
We
and
did.
That's the first time it's the first time I've been involved in planning something that had all the awards in one night. So it had a lot to go through. So it went good.
Yep. On my weekly radio show this week, the news announcer asked, he said, any specific awards that stand out in your mind? And I had to talk about our good friend Philip Konopka. He's no longer with us. He was killed in an automobile accident about a little over a month ago.
Yep.
But it was his year to win our Distinguished Service Award. And
absolutely.
In lieu of him being there, the agents that worked closely with him on a project that they had were receiving an award for, each got a chance to get up and talk and say something about, you know, their experiences working with Philip. I could do the same thing, worked the State Fair Dairy Show with him for several years. But that, to me, was a really touching point of that particular banquet.
Yeah, he and I were in core training together, and, boy, I hated to see that. He was such a good guy.
Me too. So. I always saw him at, both of us are certified crop advisors, and so we always would see each other at trainings. But I think that group of agents, you know, kudos to them.
To get through it.
Yeah. I mean, the presentation that they did, I don't think it could have been any better. They did an excellent job of honoring his memory. I don't think they could have done any better job. And I know that wasn't easy.
Yeah, and his wife is a county agent with us as well.
Right, in Carter County.
Yeah, and you know, it was tough for her to get through that too, but we was all there for her to lean on and support, so it was good.
I've had the good fortune of working with a lot of good agents through the years, but if I had to describe Philip, the word that comes to mind is solid.
Yep.
He was solid in every sense of the word, in his work, in his personal life. He just solid.
Yep. Yeah. Good folks.
Yep. That's right. That is right.
But we're past that. We're moved on into another week. We're recording a new set of shows now, and we've got a guest with us today, Dr. J.D. Green. Good morning, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. Glad to be with you all this day.
Glad to have you here. I was looking at a flyer for a pest management field day that Travis Lechleitner is doing out in Princeton, and saw your name and where you were going to be on that tomorrow, and I texted my friends here. I said, you know, we need to see if we can't catch him as he's going through, heading west, and get him to sit down and record with us. We appreciate you taking the time to do that.
Well, I'm glad to have the opportunity. It's don't have as much opportunity to interact with the agents in West Kentucky as I used to. I still do, but sure. Not as frequently as I had at one point in time. So it's always nice to come back and visit this area of the state.
You're part of a pretty good Zoom project in the weeds that a lot of us get to use from time to time. Mm-hmm. And can't say that I've logged in every week, but it's like everybody else. You got a bunch of things going on. But talk just a little bit about yourself and about the program, the time that you've been at UK.
Well, that goes back a year or two. In fact, I started in 1986 in this position as an extension weed control specialist. And I've been dealing with weeds in all types of situations, from the grain crops to pastures and forages, non-crop lawns, you name it. If it's growing where it's not supposed to be, I sometimes get involved in those situations. Actually, I did a little program on kudzu here just earlier in the year for KET. So wow. It's been interesting to be able to be engaged with a number of different situations, and it's not routine day to day. It's always something other different, it's been a good run being able to interact particularly with agents and so forth. And y'all mentioned Philip, and mm-hmm. one of the things I remember about Philip when he first calls, he says, "Hey, Doc."
Yeah, you know, that's right.
They mentioned that at the banquet, yeah. in those agents that we talked about doing that presentation. Yeah. That is one of the things that they brought up too.
Right. Yeah. So it was a pleasure to work not only Philip but a lot of agents around the state that I've known through the years. It's but anyway, it's been good, and the opportunities I've had to, and I've been pretty much to every corner of the state. Not many people have that kind of a job to be able to get to see the diversity of Kentucky mm-hmm. has.
I know that anytime I get one of those weeds and I'm like, I've looked and I've tried to figure it out, and I'm like, I don't know what this is. I send it to you, because it seems like all the oddballs are, I mean, it's like you get those difficult ones that trying to figure out what this could be and what to do about it.
I have to tell my story on JD. This is back when I came back to Extension. I had a producer that out in the pasture field sent me a picture of this weed, and I'm sure JD probably doesn't even remember, but it was purple. And so I sent it to everybody I knew, and I mean, nobody could figure it out. I finally sent it to JD, and he said, "I believe that's an escapee," and it was an ornamental that somebody had, apparently they'd taken it out there in their pasture, some cuttings or something, and this thing came up, but nobody, he correctly identified it. Yeah. And I thought, well, I would have never thought to even think about that. You know, that's my mindset was I didn't even go down that road. But JD, he identified it, so it's all good.
Well, it's whenever you've seen a number of different scenarios over the years, some things you come back and and it's been a little bit repetitive. I still get stumped, by the way. I mean, it's been one of the things that kind of gets somewhat self-taught on some of these plants that we deal with.
Well, I think too with weeds, one of the things is they can look vastly different on what stage they are.
Oh, absolutely.
And trying to identify them, sometimes it's very hard to if it's not in a particular stage. And
Well, before the show started, I got corrected. I thought I had correctly identified a weed, and JD, he looked right at it and said, "No, that's not what that is." He said, "Wait a minute, that's not what that is." So,
but that goes to exactly what Vicky's saying, because it's easy to pick up on one thing, like the white flyers we were looking at.
Sure.
To me, and there's probably a lot of things with white flyers, but this time of the year, I think poison hemlock or Queen Anne's lace, it's one of the two. And one of them's poisonous, one of them's not. You better know the difference.
Yeah. Right.
But I know there's lots of things that have similar characteristics that make them easy to confuse. So.
Oh, absolutely.
That's exactly right. You were just talking about the Zoom that you do with us, and just share a little bit about that. I know that's just a Kentucky thing. I think that's just for, I guess it's not for the public, is it?
Well, it's
in
for
the weeds.
in the weeds. It's for an opportunity to interact with the county agents.
Yeah, but talk about that, because I think that's, you know, I think that's one of those programs, though, just to show just how Extension works. Not necessarily, I know it's not a direct program for producers, but by doing that, though, we then take that information and take it out to the producer. So it is something, it's just a different way of training. But, I mean, I think that kind of started a little bit after the COVID, so kind of talk about that part, just for nothing else, about how things start and the programs and the trainings that you all do for us.
So that's interesting you say that, because it is an outcome of the COVID that we dealt with. In fact, having gone through the COVID and having to do a lot of online programs and so forth, I am not a fan of doing a program or doing a presentation just looking at my computer screen. That's it's not normal for me, or not natural, not having an audience to be able to interact with and get that those verbal feedbacks that goes with it. But as a result of going through the COVID, I felt like this might have been an opportunity for linking with the county agents, because throughout the week I get a number of inquiries about different issues and related to weed control. So actually, I think it was 2021 was the first summer I decided once a month I'm going to give an opportunity to connect with our county agents to what I called in the weeds with forages. And I was going to mainly focus on the forage crop side of things, because there's lots of other opportunities for grain crops per se. But so once a month I started that series, and I've had 30 or 40 individuals that participated in that each week. So I went through that first summer as we were coming out of COVID. We were still a little bit limited on what some of the program we could do, but I wanted to target for the agents to have specific issues and maybe share some of their own experiences to kind of learn from each other. And then I guess it was successful enough that I had a handful of agents says, are you going to do that again in 2022? So I said, yeah, we'll do that. So I started down that path of doing that, starting the spring of the year, going basically through the growing season. Well, then along with that, Carl Bradley wanted to initiate a similar type of opportunity, focus more on pest management issues for grain crops. And so he was doing that in addition to the program that I was doing for In the Weeds. Well, this summer, we've decided to combine the two together. I think we had a good discussion just this week.
I got to sit in on that one.
Yep. And it was what I liked about it is we had a lot more comments from some of the agents who were participating, sharing just what they're seeing in their counties, because that's helpful to us. Yeah. I mean, a lot of my programming through the years, it's not necessarily what I've initiated of projects that are activities that I want to initiate. A lot of my program is funneled off of what the agents are telling me and where the needs are. So I think it's been very helpful in my career to know where I need to focus more time on certain issues and be flexible through that and trying to deal with those issues. And as you said, Vicki, we have these more limited sessions with the agents, but then at the same time, hopefully giving you the tools to be able to share that with your clientele and so forth, and not always reacting, but also I try to point out a few things to be looking for in the weeks ahead.
Well, and too, it's handy for agents to hear what's going on in other counties, because we don't always get to talk to, I mean, I talk to Vicki and Jay pretty regular, but I mean, as far as a wider area of people to talk to, it's good to hear those other folks talk about what's going on in our counties, and that helps us you know what to be watching out for. If we're on the west side of Kentucky or if we're on the east side of Kentucky and we hear somebody in the west talking about something, sometimes those things are headed that way. So it's good to be able to hear from other agents and talk about that stuff.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, just an example of how things kind of transition a little bit. Most of the poison hemlock discussions I had several years ago were mostly in these central counties. But it's gotten to be more and more an issue in this part of the state, mm-hmm. and even west. I was in the purchase area earlier, just a month or so ago, and I was amazed how many little patches of poison hemlock I saw west of the lakes. I mean, I didn't realize there was that many, much of that growing in that area of the state.
Yep. Well, there's a ton of it around here now. I mean, there's just, it's everywhere, you know, and it's hard for folks to understand because, you know, I try to, if I'm spraying on the roadway, which I, in front of my house, I try to keep the roadway sprayed with for poison hemlock and stuff. But if my neighbor's got something, I'm more a thistle. And I've cut so many thistles with a grubbing hoe when I was a kid, I just hate those things. So I'm going to go spray them for them too, you know. So, but we've gotten a lot more of it here, I think, in the last few years than we've ever had.
Right.
I think so.
On, you know, you were saying you've started, I forget what year you said, but you've been able to see a lot of changes in
1986.
Okay, 86. So you've seen a lot of changes in weed control, in not only products, but also just methods, and I mean, just a lot of changes. And I've heard a lot of people, particularly over the last couple of years, have made the comment of, you know, feel like we're back before the whole Roundup Ready. It's like we had way of doing things, and then Roundup Ready technology came in, and then everything we used to do was thrown out the window, and you know, and now we're seeing kind of going back to that. So, I mean, is that kind of the way you see it as well?
Well, yeah, yes. I mean, things sort of cycle around to a certain extent as weeds begin to adapt and to be able to manage the practices that we're, you know, we get accustomed to one practice and we go down that path of doing the same thing over and over again. And then as a result, we forget about what we were doing in the past. And when I think back on even a program I'm doing tomorrow, that one of the problematic weeds that just was mandatory for control was Johnson grass. Yeah. Back when I was working in the 80s and 90s, yeah. I mean, either corn or soybeans, you had Johnson grass, it was a major issue that we had to deal with. We did not have glyphosate or Roundup to deal with it, although they were beginning to use wick applicators. Mm-hmm. Started down south in cotton, and then our soybean producers, even up in this area, were using some rope wick applicators to try to deal with the Johnson grass situation in soybeans, because we didn't have all these herbicide technologies we have today to selectively kill grasses out of soybeans, let alone selectively kill grass out of a grass crop such as corn.
Right.
So, you know, having thought about that, when you look at some of the major weed problems we were dealing with, Johnson grass is still here, but we've had some tools that have been highly effective to keep it in check for the most part, at least up to now, because things do change over time in regards to dealing with some of the weeds that we had in the past. In fact, if you looked at the overall weed control program for corn and soybeans, we spent a lot of effort just trying to put things together to throwing everything but the kitchen sink into the sprayer, trying to figure out, you know, how do we control complexity of the weed species that we had to deal with.
Yep.
And that's why glyphosate or the Roundup Ready technology was so useful in its heyday, is because it pretty much killed everything but the crop.
Right.
Because the crop had the technology to survive a herbicide that was an ideal herbicide to kill, had activity on most plants. So, and then as we started overusing it and became highly reliant on that one technology, then we start seeing escapes or plants that the populations with the genetic base of being able to survive that particular treatment. So now we're kind of back to trying to put different things together, and we talk a lot about using different herbicide sites of action, you know, and continue to maintain our rotational cropping systems and other methods to deal with some of these problematic weeds. And Johnson grass, to me, is a little bit of a good example of of that, because I think I'm seeing a little bit more Johnson grass out in some of these crop fields that we didn't see even 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Part of that is, though, is because when we start mixing things together, we run into some little bit of antagonism, mm-hmm. Environmental conditions, timing of treatments as comes into play. I don't know how we get that message across about the critical importance of timing. Had a phone call even on the way down here about lack of control of water hemp, and from what you think should have been an effective treatment, but then as I got digging into the scenario, it seems like maybe the size of the plant that they were trying to treat mm-hmm. was a little bit beyond optimum, and under the environmental stress and conditions we've had up till this rainfall event we just recently had, I guess it's not surprising that they might have had some escapes. Whether or not that's the answer to that particular situation or not, but at least, you know, you got to think about all these different factors that come into play. But yes, the weed control strategies used to be throwing everything together, and then we got real simple there for a little while, but we overdid the simplification mm-hmm. and became heavily relied. And now we're back to advocating, and it's been pleasing to see that we have a lot of producers and crop consultants and others who are advocating using different sites of action of chemistries, even at planting time, although it's a lot of individuals are reluctant to pay that money up front. Been good that I think we're adapting some of those practices. At least some of the producers that have been successful of managing some of these weeds that have become resistant to glyphosate mm-hmm. or Roundup, for example, are because they are using some different control tactics. One of the messages I've been trying to get across in the last few years during what I call my winter meeting season is basically a general concept or comment that, you know, it's a given you're going to have weed pressure.
Yes.
And using a good herbicide program may or may not give you increased yields, but I can guarantee you one thing: if you leave those weeds out there, you will have yield reductions, mm-hmm. which is costing you money.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started when I graduated college in 95. I went to work as a crop consultant for Miles Farm Supply, and that was just right before Roundup. And so, mm-hmm. you know, talking about, I mean, I walked a lot of fields, and I would take a notebook out there and write all the weeds down that was out there, and then you come back and try to figure out, what am I going to put together to be able to get the most control out of that field, and then trying to find, products that can mix together, because
right.
not every product's going to mix well together, you know, and then looking at the stage of the crop. And, you know, there was a lot of time spent on some of those difficult fields that had some difficult weeds to try to control, just trying to find that right spray program that you felt pretty confident was going to work. But then, you know, I even remember, especially in corn, spraying over the top, you had to, the timing, because if that corn got too big, you know, trying to switch over to drop nozzles and spraying with those, and how the spray guys did not like it when we had to use those, and just the control in general, you know, it just changed a lot when Roundup came along. But I remember early on hearing, you know, you and Chip Martin saying, you know, be careful. You don't want to overuse a product, because that's how we end up with resistance issues. So
you started your comments there, Vicki, was saying you got out and scouted fields. And that may be one of the things that we got away from the most during the years of being able to enjoy the Roundup Ready technology, is we had that backup, that cleanup that we could use. And scouting, I don't want to say it became irrelevant, but it became less practiced, because there wasn't as much need for it. So.
Absolutely, yeah, I think so too. In my early career, I think that's lots. Of course, individual farms now farm a lot more acres too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And there's some farms still have some scouts to not just look for weed problems, but other issues as well. But from the weed perspective, weed control perspective, you know, there's some farms had a pretty good idea what their history of those fields were and what kind of weed problems they had to deal with. That's less evident today, unless you do have a scout or someone that's out taking good records on some of these fields so that you kind of have a better idea of what's out there. One of the hardest things that we have to deal with, you all as agents and even at the state level, is someone says, I want a weed control program for my soybean field. And your first question is, so what kind of weeds do you have?
Yeah.
And you get this blank look and right. Thinking.
It's the same look every time, too, JP.
That's right.
You don't know where to start.
It's funny because that's the same look when they've got an insect problem or a disease problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just they check more for, or the weeds is kind of what's on their mind, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what stands out.
That's what
you can see.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
JD, do you think that, you know, we've had resistant weeds for quite some time now and have found, you know, resistant different species. Do you think, though, since we got Palmer and water hemp that have gotten to be resistant, do you think that kind of made people sit up and take notice a little more than what they did before?
Yeah, that's a good point, David, that 'cause when I first started working, actually a resistant weed I worked on was smooth pigweed, another amaranth,
mm-hmm.
that was resistant to triazines, atrazine and princep. That was back in the day whenever one of our primary herbicide weed control programs was atrazine and princep, two triazines. And we had some pockets in the state, and that's one of the first, some on-farm projects I worked with back in the late 80s. Now, that sort of went away as we switched to some different herbicide programs.
Right.
So most people don't realize it even occurred.
Mm-hmm. Right. I can remember the days of a lot of corn being made with 2 pounds of atrazine, and that was about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a little bit of princep thrown in with it.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, some of those issues were back in those years, 20 or 30 years or so ago. But I think, the ones like the amaranth, the Palmer amaranth and the water hemp really brought it to the forefront to take notice, because those were competitive weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it was already, those plants were pretty much already glyphosate resistant when they got introduced in the state. Now, we had some of it in the state, I think, back for several years. But as we moved equipment around, Palmer was coming in on cottonseed hulls.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of areas in my part of the state, in central or south central Kentucky and so forth. And you could track it right back to equipment or just a header on a combine being bought even in West Kentucky and brought to those farms. And it just takes a few of, you see a few plants the first year, and then they go unnoticed, and then just within 2 or 3 years you get this explosion.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got a problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I can't kill this plant.
Right. Well,
but I think it has helped open the eyes to people to realize it's a highly competitive one, and if we don't do something other.
I can remember the very first Palmer plant that I cut, and the stalk was as big around as my forearm.
Mm-hmm.
And the farm next to, this was in a tobacco patch, and the farm next to it was just eat up with Palmer.
Right.
And that was the first plant that I had ever, you know, actually saw in person.
Right.
And that's been, golly, that's been 10 years ago.
10 it's or been 12. The 10 to 15 12. Years is what we've been on this. And I was tracking the introduction across the state. It's amazing how quickly it's, you know, it started in, you see it, you're getting inquiries about it just in a few isolated counties in the state. And then Jim or Chip Martin and I were tracking this thing and got these maps. And every year it just kept adding more and more bigger counties in just a very short period of time. But here we go.
Yeah.
And it was showing up in parts of the state that I wouldn't have imagined.
Mm-hmm.
But again, going back to the, just shows our mobility and how we move things around.
You know, we think about moving moving it from field to field. If the first tobacco farmers were those that would think about that, like moving like black shank.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's funny because tobacco farmers would think about that when they was moving from field to field or borrowing equipment if they were going to do that, you know, for whatever reason. But up until, you know, we started having Palmer issues and all that, then that's when grain farmers started thinking about, ooh, we could carry this too. That, you know, because you used to didn't hear that tobacco folks was the only ones you ever heard about carrying something from field to field.
Yeah. And they produce so many seeds.
Yes.
I mean, the you know, that's the issue.
Very prolific seed production, and there's seed in no bigger than a pinhead that hide into every nook and cranny of the equipment. Now, we had a few issues, if I recall, back in my early career of Johnson grass. You know, people harvesting corn and Johnson grass infested cornfields, and that equipment going to another farm and
moving it around with the combine.
Yeah. So we had a few of those issues back in my early career as well. But here we had a plant that's highly prolific, the Palmer and the water hemp, highly prolific seed producers. That I mean, it just so quickly that got moved around.
And even when you think you really cleaned it.
Yes.
You can't get it all. I think like you were saying, that's the take home there is that.
Yeah, I remember in high school, right after I got out of high school, I went to work for a farmer, and he actually pulled around Johnson grass.
Yes.
To not spread it everywhere, and would put.
You mean like with the header, with combine?
Yeah, with the combine.
No, I've seen a lot of people.
Would not run it through his combine.
Yeah, I've seen it.
You know, and so that was, that's a big change from now, because they just. Right on through it now.
So on that note, it's kind of interesting. One of the primary questions I'm getting now about Johnson grass is actually in grass hay fields. Mm. And I'm, in my opinion, is that system is one of the best ways to spread that plant around.
Yes.
Particularly for second and third cutting hay.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're cutting hay, that equipment moves through there two or three times during that whole process.
Yep.
And you have one little patch that gets started, and then we just spread it around. We got another two or three patches, and here we go. And that's an example of a system where I've finally concluded, since we don't have any good selective herbicide tools for that situation, as we almost need to do something different in those fields for a few years to get that population back down to a reasonable level. But, again, it's another system, another farm system, but in our production practices are our biggest enemy.
Yeah, I can take you to several fields, J.D., that we cut for hay, and these are rented fields. These are fields that the neighbors just want us to cut just to kind of keep things looking good. Mm-hmm. And I can remember when there wasn't any Johnson grass on those farms. And then I can remember there's two or three spots. And then I can remember it's full.
Yes.
The whole farm's got it now. And there's not a way, if it's going to stay in that system, there's not a way to really kind of control that other than to spraying Roundup or like, but I mean it's so, there's so many rhizomes in the ground now, it doesn't matter.
Well, and the thing about Johnson grass is it's, you deal with the rhizome population, it's the seed in the soil that can remain there for a number of years.
Yeah.
And
there's a lot of weeds like that too, aren't there?
Absolutely. And some are able to take advantage of that more than others.
Right.
So you know, it's one of the things I talk about, especially whether we're talking about grain crops or particularly forage crops, is understand a little bit of the life cycle of the plants that you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if we can shortchange the ability of those plants to reproduce, is part of the game. Regardless of what tactic you're using for control efforts,
right.
Learn to know when it's going through those reproductive stages so you can kind of try to shortchange it the best we can.
Time that application.
Yes. Yeah. Because a lot of weeds we don't see until they're highly visible.
Right. Sure. You know, I think we were talking earlier about road crews out working and mowing, and I think about thistles. And it's almost like whenever they see that big purple seed head, that means it's time to go mow it. Where with the life cycle, had they done it as soon as they saw that stalk shoot up, they would have eliminated seed production from that plant for that year.
Right. And that's just one example of a lot of
weeds.
Right,
right. That's just one that comes to mind for me. Right.
You know, we refer a lot of that to the weed seed bank that soils have, and they can be viable 3 to 5 to 6, probably longer than that,
right.
JD. But, I mean, for years they can be. So when you come up on a field and you may turn it over, or you disc it or something, you have this weed that you've never seen. It's been there for a while, probably. more than likely.
Right.
So, yeah.
Of course, there's other ways that things get introduced, but I've been on a few farms over through the years where a person has done some tillage to reseed. One that stands out in particular was an individual had reseeded an old pasture field, and what came up was a lot of common ragweed. Mm-hmm. He did all this tillage in the spring of the year, just a perfect seed bed for common ragweed to yeah. take advantage of. And he was convinced it came from the seed that he yeah. purchased.
Yeah.
So I think I was able to walk him through that and help him understand that ragweed seed look a lot different than grass seed. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it just last year, I had an agent action in this part of the state that notified me and says, I had a producer that went in to buy some Kentucky 31 fescue, and he got to looking on the seed tag, and it's not uncommon for some weed seed to be identified as it goes through the regulatory process to be sowed. But on the seed tag, it identified there was a very, very small percentage of weeds, but some of that was poison hemlock.
Really?
So it was on the tag, but if this particular individual hadn't been paying attention,
right,
there was another opportunity to get something introduced that you don't want to get started.
Yeah, that's alarming a little bit. Yeah, I mean, you know, we all got a deer in the headlight look here. Our listeners can't see us, but that just goes to show you need to read and know exactly what you're getting, right. and that goes with spraying too. Know what's being put in the tank
yeah,
too.
Right.
Because there's a lot of custom application that's done. I mean, that's a big business but I always say that. And I'm not saying this against any commercial applicator because that they're doing anything wrong, but take ownership in your what's going in that tank and what's being sprayed on your farm. Not saying you need to change what's happening necessarily, but take some ownership in that and know what's going in the tank. You know, one of the questions that I get, changing the subject a little bit, one of the topics and questions that I get, it usually comes up about every year at some point in time, is going back to my crop consultant days, is, you know, when we sprayed beans, I mean, you burn them. I mean, the products that we had to spray over the top on post-application of beans,
yes.
You burn them. I mean, I think about Blazer and some of those things when you're trying to really control some tough weeds.
Right.
I want to think, is it Copperleaf that Blazer did really good on? It's been too long now. But
right.
But you really did, you know, you'd really burn them, and in some cases, might even think you killed them, but you didn't, you
yeah.
know. And
right.
And then when Roundup came along, you know, we didn't burn them. And so there's always that conversation of, was it beneficial to burn them?
Knock
them back a little bit. They start, putting on pods and not vine as much. So
right.
I'm going to put you on the spot here, JD. what is your, just share your comments about that, because I know we've all talked to producers
yeah.
about that.
Right. So the other product that was really even more of a burner was Cobra.
Yes.
Than Blazer, and they were in the same general chemical class together, but the Cobra was the mm-hmm. the hotter of the two,
yes.
if you will, and particularly what additives or adjuvants you put in the tank with
right.
it, just and the crop stage of growth and so forth. Early in the development of stage, if you make the application when the soybeans are still fairly young, as you all know, I mean, soybeans have the ability to compensate and to make up for that, and then it became a kind of a trend there for a while that about using that as a way to sort of bump yields
mm-hmm.
on these soybeans. But there was some work done by some individuals, and actually at Princeton, at the research station in Princeton, did a number of trials and could not find a yield increase as a result of that treatment. So I think from a weed control perspective, just getting rid of the weeds in itself is part of your yield boost.
Sure.
Right.
But sometimes they were using it beyond that. But we have no data that would support that you would see a yield increase as a result of burning mm-hmm. those soybeans. Now, early on when Cobra was first label for use, I walked a soybean field in which the soybeans were probably treated whenever it was definitely in the reproductive stages, if not beyond, and it defoliated the leaves. Yes.
Yeah.
That's a yield loss.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Because those beans don't have time to recover. But you basically took away all the photosynthesis going on in that plant for a period of time until the new leaves start popping out. So
almost stopped it in place for a while.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there was a timing, as we talked about earlier, and there's a timing issue, and all these different factors that go into each individual product that we use, and understanding the strengths and understanding where their precautions and the weaknesses are, and it's daunting. I mean, it's just all the different options that are out there.
Talk a little bit about how the weather conditions can affect how a herbicide works or does not work, and particularly, say, in a drought situation. If we're extremely drought, how does that affect how that product works, or does it? Mm-hmm. And then also how soil pH can affect how some herbicides can work.
Okay, well, that's
I know really that's two completely that's different two, questions, two but well, that's a loaded let's question deal, a little bit.
Let's deal with the dry weather conditions, extremely dry weather conditions, particularly since we've just experienced several weeks of that before this rainfall.
Some of us are still experiencing it.
Oh, is that right? Mm-hmm. So under those drier conditions, there is a chance of, in some cases, maybe getting a little more injury out of the crop because the crop is not able to metabolize. You know, one of the ways that you get selectivity with some herbicides is the ability of the crop to quickly metabolize the chemical down to it's not going to have an effect on the desirable crop plant. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, on the weed side of it, if you have stressed conditions and the weeds are shutting down their stomates and their other pores, if you will, into the plant, then you don't get as much chemical uptake into those plants. Or particularly extremely dry, you have these curled leaves, and you know these plants are in a kind of defensive position, so you may not get as good of uptake into the plant in that regard. Now, in regards to the soil pH factor, that's not true for all herbicides, but there are some herbicides that are impacted by pH. I think we were talking about the triazine herbicides earlier. One of the things we started to feel like we lost some control out of atrazine a little bit because under more acid pH, it breaks down more quickly. On the other hand, when you have the ALS type herbicides and things like chlorimuron that was in the old product called Classic, which is also in Canopy, and even that's also in this newer product called Trivance, you still have chlorimuron there. Under higher soil pH, those things persist longer in the soil and become more active. In fact, I had a case last year, and I think it may be involved this year with a situation in which the soil pH may be a little higher, and it just caused some soybean damage as a result of being too active. In that regard. So, and then dovetail one other piece to that to it. If it's more active and it hangs around longer under higher soil pH, you got to be more aware of what's your next rotational crop.
Right.
Yep.
Because you know you can these things
hurt that too.
And that's the thing. Getting back from the Roundup Ready age, and we talked about earlier, you start throwing these other chemistries back in the mix that we used to deal with. We've kind of lost some institutional learning here about all these different factors that come into play. And if we stay dry the rest of this year and we've used a number of these soil residual herbicides, then the alarm concerns become a little higher about, you know, being aware of that, is particularly if the things that may get applied later into the summer under drier conditions, those can come into play sometimes. Not frequently, but occasionally.
The point to ask in those questions was there's a lot of factors to think about in certain situations when you're getting ready to make any application. Sometimes it's outside of what is the weed I'm trying to control and what crop are we in.
Yes.
It goes further than that.
Right.
And knowing those situations and knowing when there might be a concern to take a step further in that, certainly if you're in a year where we're getting timely rainfalls and everything's looking good, you know, that's not something you think about.
Right.
But in a drought situation, and that's just another thing to think about when you're getting ready to make those applications.
And you got to know.
I mean, that's
the thing. You've got to educate yourself and know what you're doing, especially, you know, when you're selecting different herbicides or for whatever. You got to know.
Mm-hmm. And then, like you said, that rotation on what you're going to come in and plant behind it, particularly after, you know, events that may cause that to change from what we normally think it would be.
And whenever you talk about you need to know, maybe take it just another step beyond that in saying, even though you may not know the answer yourself, just know who you can contact.
Absolutely.
Or who can help me to,
yeah.
Or know what the key questions to ask.
Right.
Is this going to be an issue or not for me?
Yeah.
Yep.
Just,
absolutely.
You know, knowing the questions to ask. You don't necessarily have to know the answer. That's right. Just know the right questions to ask.
Correct.
And I think that was the point of even bringing that up.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that usually the case? You know, one of the things we always do, JD, with the show is we like to wrap things up with a timely tip. And we've talked about a lot of different things dealing with weed control today. But we kind of decided ahead of time that our timely tip for this show would be to avoid the potential of herbicide-resistant weeds by using a different chemistry program and or other management practices like rotations and things of that matter. When I think of control, really there's three methods. We've got chemical, we've got mechanical, and we've got cultural. So there are other options out there other than just switching from one herbicide to another that may be the best option in any particular situation.
Yes, and it's interesting you say that because back in my earlier career, we talked a lot about IPM, about using different tools in the toolbox, and those issues were discussed a lot more about the importance of crop rotation and mm-hmm. Row spacings and all those different management
right.
things.
Time to canopy on a specific crop.
Are just as important in that equation as having a chemical kill to or a silver bullet's going to solve my problem. Unfortunately, we experienced a little bit of that. We had the little silver bullet. But
we're paying for that silver bullet now.
But we overused that silver bullet to our disadvantage now.
Sure enough.
Well, we appreciate you stopping by here on your way to Princeton. I think it'll be a good field day tomorrow. It's supposed to be a hot day. I hope there's plenty of water for everybody.
Well, that's normal for a Princeton field day.
I think that's right. When you get this time of the year, this is going to be our first flirt with 100 degrees this year, but it's that time of the year when there's a Princeton field day. Used to be the big field day was every other year, and you could almost bet two things. The night before when they had the big dinner, it was going to come a flood.
Yes.
And the next morning, the humidity would be 400%, and it would be about 98 degrees to go along with that.
Yep.
So
right.
But special thanks to you for being here with us and for this week's information. And thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show and will make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.